go to one of the websites we have, which is www.reunify.org.
Okay.
www.reunify.org. And there they can volunteer in a multitude of different ways to help us assist these children, including detention site visits.
Okay.
Children,
we're going to have to leave it there, Peter Shea. We are out of time, but we will post that website on social media and we'll have you back very soon. Thank you for joining us. Okay. We are out of time. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our board op, Teddy Robinson, our assistant producer, Ramiro Funes, today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up, it's Press Watch. Then at 10, Flashpoints. Dennis Bernstein continues the special rebroadcast of the multi-part series, The Battle for Public Education in the 21st Century. At 11, Between the Covers speaks with poet Nancy Huang. At 11:30, Words and Pictures with S.W. Konser, talking with Phil Proctor, the fire sign theater humorist, about his six decades as a writer and performer. Teresa Mitchell is ready next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the NAACP kickoff to Black History Month on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library in Vancouver, Washington. The NAACP kickoff to Black History Month features performances from African drummers, actors and storytellers, artist talks, a presentation by the Buffalo Soldiers of Fort Vancouver, and much more. Again, that's the NAACP kickoff to Black History on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library, 901 C Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor One Voice, an evening on Friday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at Unity Church in Portland. The One Voice event features a film screening of Unaccompanied, Alone in America, a documentary about immigrant children who have been separated from their parents while seeking refuge in the U.S., as well as performances by Jennifer Berezin and Chris Webster. This is a benefit for Immigration Counseling Service, Oregon's oldest nonprofit immigration law firm. Again, that's One Voice, Friday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at Unity Church, 4525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, this program is dedicated to my good friend Lynn Mollick, who stood by me in my life's toughest moments and has always buoyed me up with good advice and good cheer. And shout out to Conch. Unfortunately, I must start today with warnings of war. From Radio Havana, Cuba, Syria warns that it could use its right to respond in self-defense to recent Israeli air raids against a civilian airport near Damascus by striking Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport if the United Nations fails to act against Israeli aggression. Israel mounted another aerial aggression in the early hours of Monday, which the Syrian Defense Forces said included land and airstrikes through successive waves of guided missiles. The Syrian Air Defense Network was promptly activated, and they say they shot down most of the hostile projectiles before reaching their designated targets. And departing from that text, the video that you can find, I guess you'd have to go to YouTube to find most of it, is pretty dramatic. Incoming missiles being hit by the Syrian Russian-built air defense system. This is a serious situation. They write, Syria addressed letters to the United Nations warning that it could use its right to self-defense by striking the airport in the Israeli capital unless the UN Security Council steps in to stop the Tel Aviv regime's aggression. So that is going to the Security Council. And meanwhile, Russia has urged Israel to stop its spontaneous airstrikes on Syria after the Israel military carried out fresh strikes against targets near the Syrian capital, Damascus. So there's more on that article at rhc.cu/en. I want to ask my Israeli-linked Jewish friends to contact your contacts, the Likudniks in the Knesset, and whatever contacts you have, and maybe Mr. Ron Wyden, and try to direct some attention against this aggression and try to dial this down. This could be dangerous, and hopefully it'll die down. But the Syrian government still has a very strong military presence in Damascus, and this isn't something that Israel can do outside of a military context. And of course, Russia is acting with its defense commitments with Syria. Unfortunately, that is not the only war threat right now. You may have heard that Vice President Pence issued a dramatic and, of course, completely false call for support for a previously unknown man in Venezuela, in Caracas, who he wants to support as the government. So Vice President Pence and the Trump government want to select Venezuela's new leaders. And I'm going to explain why they're doing that in a moment. The reasons may surprise you. But this from the Mexican publication La Jornada. By the way, Mexico is not supporting this. They write, Dateline Havana, the government of Cuba expressed its firm support to its ally Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. Unlike more than a dozen Latin American countries that recognize the Venezuelan parliament leader, the opposition Juan Guaido, I hope I pronounced that right, as president in charge. Our support and solidarity to President Nicolas Maduro before the imperialist attempts to discredit and destabilize the Bolivarian Revolution is a quote from the Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel. He wrote that on Twitter. In parallel, Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez also declared his firm support for the existing government in Venezuela and considered Guaido's self-proclamation as a coup attempt, which it surely is. Now, continuing from La Jornada, the government of Mexico will not participate in the shunning of the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and that's from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The Mexican Foreign Ministry said in an official position paper, quote, Mexico will not participate in the delegitimization of the government of a country in which it maintains diplomatic relations. Thus, it departs from said action by countries of the American continent, such as the United States. Meanwhile, in a joint position released by the Uruguayan Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Mexico and Uruguay urged the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to negotiate with the opposition led by the President of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, and the international community in order to reduce tensions and avoid an escalation of violence that could aggravate the situation. In the administrations headed by Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador and the Uruguayan head of state, Tabaré Vázquez, they explained that in accordance to the principles of international law, they asked all parties involved, both inside the country and abroad, to find a peaceful and democratic solution to the complex crisis facing Venezuela. To achieve this goal, they argue, both countries should propose a new process of inclusive and credible negotiation with full respect for the rule of law and human rights. The Uruguayan and Mexican governments, in line with the declarations of the United Nations and the European Union, as well as the governments of Spain and Portugal, expressed their full support, commitment, and willingness to work together in favor of stability and the welfare and peace of the Venezuelan people, end quote. Why is this happening? You may want to know. Well, Venezuela is a major producer and exporter of minerals, notably in bauxite, coal, gold, iron ore, and oil, and the state controls most of the country's vast mineral reserves. That's from Wikipedia. In 2003, estimated reserves of bauxite, that's where you get aluminum, totaled 5.2 million tons. the third largest producer of coal in Latin America after Colombia and Brazil. Venezuela produced 5.8 million short tons in 2002 as compared to 9.3. Excuse me, that's about coal. My bad. Now let me talk about oil. And before I get into this, I'll just say this is about oil. It's about money, and it's most certainly also about gold. There's a great deal of gold in Venezuela. Continuing with the article from Wikipedia, with 77 trillion barrels of proven oil reserves in 2004, Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in South America and the sixth largest in the world, more than Canada, Mexico, and the United States combined. Venezuela's 2002 of 2,800 barrels per day of crude was a drop of 8.3% over 2001 in the country's lowest production since 1994. Obviously, that's way out of date, but their production of oil has gone way down. And the real reason for that is that there's two main reasons. I feel like the Spanish Inquisition. I'm going to add to that three main reasons. Well, anyway, however many main reasons there are, let me lay some of them out. First, the oil that they have is tarry oil. It requires a great deal of refining, and when the price of oil drops as it has internationally over the last decade, that oil is not as desirable and can't compete as well. Secondly, the refineries have long been controlled by the United States, and they have had great difficulty in getting them to function properly, because after all, the oil companies that control the U.S. government don't want to share their wealth with the Venezuelan people. There are other reasons. I'll get to that in a minute, but they're not getting the money from the oil, and they can't right now until the price of oil goes up and until they get full control of their refineries, which includes control of the technology of the refineries. Now let's talk about gold. In the Orinoco Arc and other areas, Venezuela has the second highest gold reserves in the world. Most people don't realize that Venezuela, there on the northern edge of South America, has entirely different regions incorporated into its political boundaries. And the highlands are not what most people imagine when they think of Venezuela. In the highlands, the average temperature is around 49 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a very different place, and they have a tremendous amount of gold, and it's only really just starting, pardon me, to be exploited. I'm going to set aside the ecological problems with that and just say that this is very important for the survival of Venezuelan people, because in a similar manner to the way U.S. treats Cuba, it goes around the world and breaks up Venezuelan deals. The U.S. is very much into a long-term process of destabilizing Venezuela and disrupting their production of wealth in order to get to the end game of putting a puppet comprador government in place. And that's what they really want. They want that gold, and they want that oil, and they want it, they, meaning our rulers, want it on the terms of complete exploitation and impoverishment of the population. This is what makes billionaires. You can't have billionaires without poverty. The two are linked hand in hand, inseparable. But just to mention the ecological edge of that, eco-socialist protest resulted in cancellation of a 30-year, 60,000-acre coal lease. They have a great deal of coal as well, and there are problems with the gold. In 2016, protests were underway with respect to the gold mining joint venture. Now, Venezuela has been trading this gold directly with Turkey in order to get food. And this is important because the food is distributed by the military. The Venezuelan government has been making some pretty cruel choices. I don't know that I support all of them. However, I do recognize that the context is they are forced, like most countries or people who are at war, and they are at an economic war at this point, with a very, very powerful aggressor of the United States. They must choose between bad choices. And what they chose to do, what the Maduro government has done, is they put the Army, Navy, and Air Force in charge of the food. They trade gold directly with Turkey and probably other places for food. And so the Army gets fed, and through the Army, other people get fed, and it's a lousy system. And people are up in arms about it, but it's the only food coming in, because if it were up to the United States, the entire country would be absolutely as starved as the people of Yemen are under the U.S.-supported bombing campaign that is coordinated with the... I want to characterize the Saudi government theological fascists. How do you say that? Theo-fascists. So let me give you a little bit of the other side on this. This is the news you're not supposed to know. This is Press Watch on KBOO Portland. It's 9:15. In a few minutes, I'm going to be joined by Reverend Sandra Decker of Strike Debt Portland. Looking forward to that, and I will be taking your calls at that time as well. But let me tell you how this is being reported in the U.S. to the extent it's being reported at all, which is interesting. It's gone from the news cycle already, I've noticed. It's gone from the top page, so to speak. Bloomberg, the billionaire, Bloomberg.com, put out an opinion piece, and they say, "Give Donald Trump credit." I'm quoting, "On Wednesday, the U.S. president recognized Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as the country's interim president. At least a dozen other countries in the Western Hemisphere have since followed suit," they write. "There were signs that such a move was in the works," and they go on with the official policy of just how terrible Venezuela is, because they say socialist, 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 and what they really mean is because they're not allowed to extract every penny for themselves. And skipping ahead, "For some on the left, Trump's Venezuela policy raises uncomfortable memories of America's Cold War interventions in Latin America. But there's an important distinction," they say. "During the Cold War, the U.S. supported dictatorships and juntas as a bulwark against international communism. It was a foreign policy that prized alliances over democracy. In Venezuela," they write, "Trump is trying to help restore democracy." And that's the advantage of writing something down, is you can do it without cracking up. They write, "Guaido's claim to power has a legal basis under Venezuela's constitution." And of course, you know, there's some truth to that. It's a hell of a stretch. I mean, his power, the assembly that he represents was marginalized under a questionable procedure by Maduro's government. And they did that because, as I said, they are forced into bad choices. It was replaced by another assembly, and they do have elections, and despite what you may have heard, I wouldn't say that their elections are much worse than U.S. elections. They have some democracy, and whatever democracy they have is certainly more democratic, if I may put it that way, than having a foreign power, the United States, simply choose a government and choose a president, and then support that with economic embargo. And also the U.S. Department is saying, the U.S. Is saying through various politicians that they will, you know, flood the country with money. So like, you know, you're tired of starving, we're just going to give you all this money. And some people, you know, you get hungry enough, you want to believe. Some people in Venezuela do believe that, but the army doesn't and the majority doesn't. And so the problem with this is that... the Trump administration, I don't want to over-exaggerate. This process of starving Venezuela started a long time ago, and it's part of the real government of the United States. The oil companies and the corporations and the Pentagon, world's largest consumer of oil and largest polluter, they were very much moving forward on this project of destroying Venezuelan democracy under Obama. So it ain't really Trump. It's, you know, he's in place right now, and, you know, with his racist belligerence, he makes a good head for this sort of policy, I suppose, you know, from that point of view. Bloomberg loves him. Bloomberg was making reference to Pearl Harbor by saying Roger Noriega, a former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, now at the American Enterprise Institute, speaks regularly to former military officers. They say Maduro's days are numbered. He has made a terrible enemy, they tell him to sound familiar. His name is Donald Trump. And that's the sort of thing that you can find on the corporate-owned media, on Bloomberg, in any event. Well, now it's 19 minutes after the top of the hour. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This program is called Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. And I am glad now to be able to welcome to the KBOO airwaves once again, Reverend Sandra Deckard. Thank you so much for joining me. Can you define once again Strike Debt and tell me your role within the organization?
Thanks, Teresa. Strike Debt got started out of Occupy Wall Street, and the national group put together a book called The Debt Resistors Operation Manual, and it covers every form of debt out there and solutions to problems people are having with debt. Strike Debt Portland, the past 2 years, has worked on educating graduating seniors by offering scholarships at two different high schools each year. And we asked the students to write an essay on what student debt was going to mean to them in their lives. This year, 2019, we have moved to a reverse scholarship. And a reverse scholarship goes to those seniors who are having their Social Security checks garnished for student debt. This is grandparent, parent debt, and many of them may have signed loans from their children or their grandchildren who didn't get the jobs they thought, couldn't make the money they thought, and defaulted on them. And the government is taking the money out of Social Security checks. So we want to draw attention to that, and we want to be part of the effort to stop that.
I want to draw attention to that. I mean, how insane can a country get? Oh, by the way, I don't give much acknowledgement to the engineers, and I just want to thank John and thank Clementine for being really on top of it. I mean, I can just have a guest walk in, open the mic, and hey, that's pretty good, especially when you're talking about a volunteer who comes in and operates a system that has literally hundreds of buttons. So good job there. Thanks very much. And Strike Debt Portland, as you say, is trying to address this insanity of not wiping out, but garnishing the pensions of people our age and older who really need all of that pension and more to survive, many of whom are literally living in a tent in the sidewalk. This is how ugly things have gotten under Reaganism.
Yes, exactly. And we have two remarkable speakers joining us. And one is Nicholas Hartlip. And Nicholas was actually here last year for Portland Debtors Assembly. And he's going to be on the line with us talking with another professor, Kay Taylor. Both of them have articles in a really remarkable book, The Neoliberal Agenda and the Student Debt Crisis in U.S. Higher Education. And Kay Taylor's chapter is right spot on to what we're talking about. It's
we're talking about Chapter 4 in the Debt Resistors Operation Manual?
No, that one's on all kinds of debt. This one is the Neoliberal Agenda book, and it's Golden Years in the Red, Student Loan Debt as Economic Slavery. And Kay Taylor is a professor at Kansas State University. And Nicholas is they're both assistant professors, associate professors, and he's in Michigan at Metropolitan University. Both of them have taught in elementary school, got master's degrees of science, and have deep education, PhD in the field of education. Both of them also have worked on racism. And Teresa, I think they're both on the line right now.
Well, let's check on that. Clementine, do we have those? We have our callers, I mean, our guests on the line. Hi.
Nicholas is here.
Hello, Nicholas. And
yeah.
All right.
Hello, I'm Kay. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Well, let me ask you then, Kay, are you part of the Portland chapter, or where are you calling in from?
I'm in Kansas.
You're at in Kansas.
Kansas State University, so.
Okay, and Nicholas, are you in town?
Yes. No, I'm calling from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay, so we've got a nationwide nationwide reach here. All right. Tell me, what are your roles within Strike Debt? Let me start with Kay.
I think Sandra got my name from Nicholas about my book chapter, and so I'm new to Strike Debt.
Okay.
In Portland, and basically was invited to participate in this getting the word out effort today for especially senior citizens.
And Nicholas?
Yeah, so Kay's, maybe Kay could talk about her chapter, but I put together the book, and Kay's story is really relevant to this discussion of seniors and student loan debt. There's so many impacts, collateral consequences that student loan debt is having on society, on our economy. And some people might be misinformed, thinking that it's an issue for younger folks, but it's older folks who are nearing retirement and or are retired that carry debt. And I don't know, Kate, do you want to talk about what you wrote in your piece? Because it was a fascinating book chapter.
Well, thank you. Sure. I'll start out by saying that one thing that's especially frustrating to me with all when you see and encounter these things about student loan debt for all age groups is when they focus on being in default and they ignore the structural and institutional and issues of power and ignoring the human condition and, you know, a reflection of the values, I think, in our country. When they ignore that and basically criminalize or demonize, in my view, people who are in default. I'm fortunate to say that I am not yet in default, but that's a distinct possibility. Giving a little background, I started graduate school when I was 47 years old as a single mother with two kids at home on welfare. And I'm a first-generation college student. I don't really have a very solid grounding in finances. And so I took out the maximum amount of federal student loans that was allowed each semester. And one area that I am fortunate in is that it was during a time period when there were still subsidized student loans for graduate students. Since 2012, that no longer exists. So anybody pursuing graduate education starts incurring with federal loans unsubsidized, and the interest starts accruing immediately, which is even, you know, creates an even worse situation. But by the time I finished I did my master's and PhD back to back in 5 years, and by the time I finished, and I think at the time I wrote the book chapter, I was about 65 or 66 when I wrote the book chapter. I'm now 69. At the time I finished my degree, and I had, I think I used the maximum amount of deferments, which is 36 months, because when I graduated, I didn't get a job right away, a tenure-track job right away, so I couldn't really feel comfortable making payments if I didn't know I was going to have employment right away. So by the time I deferred, my deferments ran out, and I consolidated. The original amount was $69,300, approximately.
Wow.
And another area that I was fortunate, when I consolidated at that point in time, you know, as well as having all federal loans and not any private lenders, my interest rate was 3.125%, which is considerably lower than students are faced with today. I'm not real current or absolutely sure, but I think that amount could be, you know, up 6% and up. And someone can correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, when it's consolidated, that's a vicious interest rate.
It's horrible.
Teresa, can I jump in and say something?
Yes, please.
So Kay's chapter in her piece, in her story, really put into context what's going on nationally, because as she pointed out, she was lucky in some respects, you could use that term, lucky in air quotes, for her federal loans. But relevant to this discussion are that federal loans can be harder to get rid of during bankruptcy, right? So the government can garnish your wages and, you know, take 50% of your Social Security check. Whereas private loans don't have the garnishment powers, and there's, you know, statutes of limitations on collections. But I think I want to say something related is what she talks about in her story is how she got her education, formal education, at an older age. And she talks about accumulation or disaccumulation. And historically, yeah, in this country, younger folks, when you have your life ahead of you, and your health, you can accumulate wealth and amass wealth and assets. But the dilemma that's occurring now for the younger folks, millennials, is they're not accumulating, they're disaccumulating. So their net worth, I've heard there are people that, you know, that are worth more dead alive, meaning, right, you have a life insurance policy, but you have no assets, no income. And so home ownership historically is, you know, that's your nest egg. But now folks can't buy homes because they have debt, so much so that they can't qualify. And then you have the older folks who are attempting to help perhaps their children or grandchildren. And so they're in retirement or getting close to retirement. They might sign on, you know, co-sign, and they become indebted themselves. And so in preparation for our conversation today, I was talking to Sandra on the phone, and I said, you know, the younger generation's damned now, and the older generation's damned. They got through okay, but they're not going to get out okay. And so this whole snare, this whole it's an insidious problem. And furthermore, I mean, Social Security is going to be gone if the current patterns hold very soon, unless they change it.
Well, no, I want to contest that. Social Security isn't in that bad shape. There may be some reductions coming forward if we don't change the cap on on contributions, and if we don't allow people into the country. The people who are coming up from the Mexican border, trying to cross the southern border, are a godsend. We need them demographically. We need them to pay into Social Security. We need them, and the racist wall, the hate wall, is a strike against your Social Security prospects as well as anything else. You are listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, and I'm here with Sandra, and I have Nicholas and Kay on the line. Sandra, would you like me to read this announcement?
Sure.
Okay. There's a forum on Golden Years in the Red, Parent and Grandparent Student Loan Debt, sponsored by Strike Debt Portland. This is going to be on Tuesday the 29th, so it's coming up, 5:30 to 7 p.m. It's in the U.S. Bank Room in the first floor near the entrance of the main library. That's one of those free meeting rooms that they have, the main library downtown, 810 Southwest 10th Street. There's going to be speakers, testimonials, networking, and new Strike Debt Portland reverse scholarships, which Sanja is going to explain in just a moment. She writes, join us this Tuesday to raise awareness of parent-grandparent student loan debt, including Social Security check garnishments. Nearly 200,000 people so far garnished with their Social Security checks, an insane situation. Give those in that situation the opportunity to tell their story. Learn about Strike Debt Portland's new reverse scholarship to reimburse a small portion of the Social Security check garnishment for student debt. If you or anyone you know is among those in the Portland area who are spending golden years in the red with student debt, including having Social Security wages garnished, please attend this forum. Contact Strike Deck Portland to become part of the solutions. Sandra at revdecker@msn.com, 650-303-1176. Roberta at emilysing@aol.com, and we'll give those numbers again, endorsed by the Gray Panthers and by KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM. And now that I've rattled on, Sandra, you have something to add.
Well, I did mention at the beginning the reverse scholarship. There's probably nothing new under the stars, but we think we invented it. And instead of giving money upfront to high school graduates, we are going to reimburse some of the money that people have had garnished from their Social Security checks. We're looking for local people in the Portland area who are especially struggling, low income, and all they need to do is get their story on our Facebook page, Strike Debt Portland.
Thank you. Well, you are listening to KBOO Portland, and we're talking about student loan debt in the context of the debt crisis and the poverty crisis that the United States is facing. And I want to bring that out, and I want to frame it that way, because this is what the corporate-owned media and the billionaire-owned society really, really doesn't want you to think in terms of. We are facing massive poverty in the United States, and you're facing poverty when your own living situation, when your housing and your ability to have a stable life is dependent so much on the next paycheck that were you to lose it, like people are right now under the Trump administration with the hate wall shutdown, you would be in danger of becoming homeless. And that is about half of us. And more than that, even more than half of us don't even have $1,000 in reserve. This is poverty. It's poverty because housing prices are so high and wages are so low and so scarce. We have mass poverty in the United States, and Strike Debt is actually dealing with it. And so I'll go back to my guest now, starting again with Sandra.
Well, Kay said in her article, indebted collegians are controlled through manipulation and fear and cast into the bottomless pit of economic slavery. And I wanted to go back to Kay right now and have her discuss how at age 69, she's still working full-time, she still has student debt, and how is this impacting her life, her family, her choices?
Thank you, Sandra. I would like to add, too, or remind you before I respond to that, that it's not only Social Security that is garnished, but also disability checks.
Oh. Right, right.
Yeah, which to me is
disgusting.
I don't know. Yeah, it's
predatory, vampiric,
unconscionable, really. Because anything anybody receives through either one of those methods or forms of payment probably isn't. they're probably lucky to be able to survive. But in terms of how does this impact me? Well, I'm fortunate and happy that I love what I do, and I love my profession and the people I work with, and so I'm happy that I can continue to work as long as I guess my health and stamina hold out. My family is in Iowa, and so if and when I'm able to retire, that's where I plan, to go back to my home there. I kept my home, which again, I'm more fortunate than a lot of people because I inherited a home from my parents when they passed, which was paid for. And I suppose if things, worse came to worse, I would have to sell it. I don't hope that isn't the case, but I just plan to keep working as long as I'm able, and I sort of, on one level, judge that by my ability to continue to drive back and forth between Kansas and Iowa.
Wow. So did you say you're 69? And you're
correct.
Working, and you have to look at losing your home, your ancestral home, over this. Well, I want to, are you still there, Nicholas?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I just wanted to check. Well, radio housekeeping, I guess. I want to throw something into this mix, and that is the moral, and we can put that word in scare quotes, the moral onus that people feel in terms of debt repayment. People feel bad when they're not able to keep up with their debt and when they're unable to repay it. But I want to say something about that. When you make a promise to repay something, it's on the premise that what you're getting is real. It's framed within you're going to be able to get this money and you're going to participate in an economy in which you're going to have a chance, more than a chance, almost a certainty it used to be, that you would be able to pay it back bit by bit. And there's the question of interest and all that. But I want to explain that it's a false premise. And here's part of why it's false. Not just that the economy can't support education, the jobs and education paradigm that you were presented with. It's also the fact that the money did not exist until you borrowed it. You created it by borrowing it. Banks create money from debt. And it's weird, and it's hard to, I'm not going to try to explain it to you precisely. But basically, the process of money creation can be illustrated with the following example. Person A deposits $1,000 in a bank. The bank keeps $100 in reserve, and the central bank to make a profit. The bank loans the remaining $900 to a customer B. B spends the $900 by buying something from C. C deposits the $900 with their bank. C's bank keeps $90 as reserves and lends the remaining $810 to another customer D. If this chain continues indefinitely, then in the end, an amount, a debt, approximating $10,000 has gone into circulation and has therefore become part of the total money supply. You're creating money by going into debt. You did create money, and you created it for the banksters. By the way, when I say banksters, there's some of you who hear Jews, and you're absolutely wrong, and you're racist. Don't ever do that. That's just part of it now, because actually that indebtedness that you took on is now an asset for the bank that you got it from. That asset, what I just explained, that's the way it used to be done. Now it's just a fraction of what they actually do with it. They gamble with it. They create collateralized debt obligations with that, and they create these monopoly money gambling pieces, and they make bank, so to speak, on what you have done. So the fact that you have borrowed this money for this education has resulted in trillions of dollars for the super rich. You haven't hurt anyone. And I would say morally, in this context of impoverishment and in the context that we just defined, this debt peonage, this what's the word for people who came into the country as essentially slaves, and I can't think of that word right now.
Indentured
servants. You are an indentured servant. That's not moral. So take the moral out of this. You need to survive. That's moral. You need to support your family. That's moral. Don't get worked up, and for God's sake, don't ever think about suicide, because you can't pay back this imaginary debt, which when you get right down to it is patterns in a computer making other people rich. Don't fret about that. So now and I'll get down off my soapbox and let y'all get down with what you're trying to explain before. Go ahead, Sandra.
Well, we have the ability to forgive the debt, and that too can create money for the country. There's $1.5 trillion in student debt, and that's all ages. But Secretary of Education DeVos said, well, it's not fair for the taxpayers to give a ride. Right. Laugh, Kay. Right. And I laughed too when I heard that. But in other countries, they don't use taxes to pay for They do use taxes to pay for education, free education, not for removing debt. On to you, Nicholas.
Well, so Americans over 60 or older, they're the fastest growing segment of student loan borrowers. And that number's quadrupled between 2005 and 2015. That's according to Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So they're really co-signing, they're helping their children or their grandchildren secure maybe a Parent PLUS loan
The irony, too, the sad irony is that these loan forgiveness programs, one of the members of Strike Debt pointed out in her research that very few actually that are eligible are actually getting those loans forgiven. 1% of legitimate applicants who've applied for that the federal student loan forgiveness, that's 96 people out of 30,000 plus who've applied for it.
Let me expand on that for a moment. That's happened here at KBOO. So you're talking about the public service loan forgiveness, and that just turned out to be a total scam, as you were saying, and a heartbreak for people who had thrown their lives into very low paying. I mean, KBOO does not pay very much, I'm sorry to say, very low paying jobs. And service to the community, and then found out that they weren't going to get student loan forgiveness after all.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is a very, there's tentacles that the AARP, I mean, the retirement agencies, they're concerned about student loan debt affecting older people who do co-sign for. So it's the baby boomers, you know, the 50 to 72-year-olds. So I'm 35 myself. So thinking about Kay's book chapter, I hope that I have time to accumulate assets and retirement. But paying off my student loans is a challenge.
Sandra, shall I read this paper that you handed to me?
It's probably too long, but there is a woman who has who is suing because she was told that she would get the public service debt reduction. And 7 years out of the 10, she then found that she had the wrong kind of loan. And that's the games they're playing.
And the numbers I seem to recall about this are something like 98 to 99% of people found out at the end of the 10-year period when they first started popping up in 2007 that they didn't qualify.
Right. Kay, do you have something on that?
I do, because, different loan programs came out after I consolidated my loan. And mine was the graduated payment, which I honestly have to say I'm shocked that they even allowed me to do that based on my age and the amount of debt. But nevertheless, when that public service loan came out, I think it was maybe 2012, my loan was sent from the Department of Education to Cornerstone Loan Service, which is in Utah. So I called them when I found out about this public service, and they told me that the amount that I had paid to date, none of it would count, and that I would have to then switch to this other loan to be able to qualify for the 10-year public service forgiveness. And then they quoted payments that I could in no way afford. So it was basically just pointless for me. And I too also read something recently about it's pretty much fraud, not to mention predatory lending, what they've done to people with these public service loans, that they take them out and then they don't allow payment. They do everything they can to keep from forgiving the loans.
I have a story of my own student loans. They were only $2,000 because I went to school back when tuition was a few hundred dollars. That turned into $13,000 after years and years of poverty. But I did something about it. And my attitude towards the banking system is predicated on my knowledge of it. In other words, I'm a freaking pirate. And I decided I was going to take a pirate attitude towards this. I didn't have $13,000 for them, and I didn't want my wages garnished for it. So here's what I did. I don't know if you can do this, but I'll tell you what I did, and it worked. I eventually dodged that loan until the point I got a loan. In this case, it was a subprime loan that was intended to backfire on me. I managed to turn that around by backfiring on them. Long story short, I took a loan which was replaced with another loan which paid the student debt. So then when I went into Chapter 13 bankruptcy, I was able to take a loan which appeared to be clean of student debt, I think, although it technically could have been claimed to be tainted by, and as we've been saying, you're not allowed to go into bankruptcy on student debt. But the loan over the loan. It was not visible to the bankruptcy judge. It was not a collateralized loan. And it was stripped. It was destroyed. $80,000 went away. I have a house with good equity. My credit is 815. I've beaten them.
Yay!
And it can be done. And you should do it. And that's an anti-capitalist. Was that what?
Was that a private loan with a bank? Or
yes.
Was it the federal government?
That was a private loan. And okay. The federal government, of course, under bankruptcy, the judge stripped away under Chapter 13, which I paid in full. I paid all my, I'm using the word collateralized wrong. I want to say there's a real estate term for whether it was a balloon note. I rolled over the balloon note a couple of times, and then I bounced it into Chapter 13 and destroyed it. They stripped it away.
So Teresa, thinking about your story, home ownership, folks who are more privileged, who maybe own their home outright potentially and want to help their grandchild or something, they might do a home equity line of credit, which potentially could be at a low rate relative to the federal student loan at 6-8%. But you have to have those assets accumulated. And so I think of Kay, who went into a serving profession, education, to prepare teachers and help society, just like social workers, counselors. It's a relatively low status position, profession, lower paid, you know, than a business area. But she's kind of screwed in the sense of the loan, the loans that she had to take out to fund her education. So also part of it is higher education. We're part of that dilemma too, because we're so costly. And so it's a very complex, you need to have multiple shows on student loan debt to even begin to scratch.
I think you're right.
Right.
Well, I also want to say in terms of debt, there are other strategies. There was another loan that I had that I wiped out in that way. It was just under $10,000. And I was able to use the fact that it was a credit debt. And before I even went into bankruptcy, I was able to stop collection of that because they're making so much money by selling debt. The banks sell debts to people who sell it to others, and they keep trying to collect it. I took a third-tier collector to arbitration, and they simply didn't want to pay for the arbitration. And here again, I'm making a long story short, but I learned the rules of the games. I went to the arbitration, and they didn't want to pay a lawyer for it, and so that got stopped. And that can be done.
Good work. I wanted to ask, Nicholas, is there a way that our listeners can get a hold of a copy of The Neoliberal Agenda and the Student Debt Crisis in U.S. Higher Education? It has so much good information in it that would be of value to people.
Well, thank you for saying that. What I would suggest, and it's ironic, too, that a professor is saying this, those books are so damn expensive. So what I would suggest they do is, they, depending on where they live and work and call their community, is to go to the public library, request a librarian, order it, and multiple people can check it out. And or if there's a way to ask a local university or community college to purchase the book. I think it's like, I'm going to be very honest, over $100 for a hardback. So to get it through interlibrary loan, certainly they can look up the title on Amazon and purchase it and send it to themselves that way. But that's what I would suggest.
Good idea.
To get
really
a copy.
Good idea.
But that's part of the whole capitalist society. You know, us professors, we do all this research and we publish this book, and then the publishers, it's a form of academic capitalism where they will sell the book for outrageous amounts, profit. And when people say, oh, well, don't you get royalties? Yeah, pennies, literally.
That's another hellish scam, isn't it? We're getting towards the top of the hour. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm here with Reverend Sandra Decker and Nicholas Hartung and Kay. I'm sorry, I forgot your last name.
Taylor.
Kay Taylor. And we have been talking about student debt. There's so much to bring into this, and as you were saying, Nicholas, it would take several programs to cover it well. But there's something else I want to bring up, and that is the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. It doesn't protect you from those attempting to collect a personal debt, but it does apply to third-party debt collectors. And it's a set of rules that you need to know because it is often violated. And when it is violated, it can turn out that they owe you money. Yeah, no kidding. And there are lawyers who deal with this. And I also want to say that if you're in debt and you're worried about it and you're freaking about it, I said, don't worry about the moral aspect of it because it's it's not what you ever thought. And the other part is it's free to talk to a bankruptcy lawyer. Even if you don't qualify for bankruptcy, even if you're not going to go that route, when you talk to a bankruptcy lawyer, you're going to learn things that will make, I guarantee, you will feel much better and it won't cost you. And you can do that, you know, just look it up on the web right now. Find a bankruptcy lawyer and go have a talk with them about your situation. They'll be glad to talk to you. It might be that you, I mean, you know, they get paid. It's working out fine for them. But those suicidal thoughts, they're going to go away after you talk to a lawyer.
All right. I just once again want to tell the listeners that we have a forum coming up this Tuesday, January 29th at the Main Library downtown, 5:30 to 7. And we're hoping that people will come and share their stories. And we're also hoping that Teresa Mitchell, our host at KBOO, is going to be there. You can tell she has a lot of knowledge to share. We sure wish that Nicholas and Kay were closer, and hopefully in the future we're going to get them here, because both of them have won award after award after award for the incredible work they've done. And I want to give them each an opportunity. Looks like we have 5 minutes, so 2 minutes to wrap up and have the last say.
Oh, you should do radio. That's good. Go ahead. You want to start, Nicholas?
Sure. Yeah, so I'd just like to point out the great work that Strike Debt's doing. Reach out to them locally, and even if you're listening outside of the area, they've done some pretty innovative ways. When I was there, I overheard a program in which they help repair credit through a micro way of, for folks with little amounts of money, you can change your credit score, and that's very beneficial. The resistor manual is very good, so check that out. I think it's open access. And just to, you know, if you're not raging against the machine, you're raging with it. So I think that KBOO will appreciate educating listeners and building solidarity. To check out the book, certainly to have a library purchase it, because it's too expensive for a general person to buy it.
Great. Right on. I like to say you can't be neutral on a moving Titanic. You want to have last word, Kay?
Well, I would like to thank you for the invitation, and as well thanks to Nicholas, because he's the one who started the idea and the book that gave us the opportunity. And as well to Strike Debt, I reiterate what Nicholas said, because it's these types of movements and people that we need happening across the country, and building an effort and an awareness to make change for things to happen, because it just can't continue and have a sustainable life for us or our children or our grandchildren. And we need to follow suit with maybe some older and wiser cultures and societies who value their people and they value humans, and provide higher education at no cost to the country or to the people who are interested in it, as well as even pursuing, you know, other venues. Everybody doesn't have to go to college, but obviously I'm one who supports that. But I just like to thank you for the opportunity, and I appreciate that the effort is borrowing or using golden years in the red, because I think it's a very apt description.
Well, thank you very much for contributing to this by calling in, and hopefully I'll talk to you again before too long. It's almost the top of the hour. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And Sandra, I guess I'll let you have the last word as the music begins to roll there.
All right. Well, remember, you are not alone. You are not alone, A-L-O-N-E, and you are not alone, L-O-A-N.
Excellent. StrikeDebtPortland.org is where you can find this information, StrikeDebtPortland.org. And of course, the event is coming up, so you can find that as well. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM in Cascadia from our giant Eiffel Tower on the hill and other frequencies in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Studios.